Dash number 12884, workers from Supermarine, Southampton, during the war, South Reel 2.
Came to fruition because it was bombed to pieces when the works was bombed.
Can I go back even further, even perhaps before you gentlemen worked at Supermarines, do you have memories of the final Schneider Trophy race?
Yeah, it was there.
Yeah.
I've still got the original programme.
Where did you watch it from?
From Cowshop, as a boy. Because my brother at that time was actually working on the seaplanes, the S6. Now I can remember the S5 and the S6 and S6B and the Italian Mackies. As a matter of fact, I met some of the Italian pilots at Calshot 3 or 4 years ago who came over for a visit. Yeah.
And any detailed memories? How did you know that they'd retained the trophy? I suppose loudspeaker announcements or?
If I remember rightly, they announced it over the tannoy that the faster speed had been attained by the S6B, which in itself told you that we'd won the race.
Mm.
Didn't need to be told.
And the cup.
And the cup.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Is it possible to interrupt
again? Certainly, yes.
So, I remember this very well. I don't know whether you remember this episode. I, by now, was at Wall Street. Excuse me. The firm knew that everybody was intensely interested in the race. Do you remember them organising the flat-topped bottom barges, timber barges, to go down to view it off down to Solent?
I remember seeing them, but of course at that time I wasn't working
for
them.
Well, I was on board. I look back now and wonder how on earth they got away with it. A flat-topped, flat-decked, flat-bottomed timber barge, like the old things that used to ply up from the local timber yards. They had rows of chairs, just seated, no railings around it, no nothing, just rows and rows of chairs. I think they charged us about the old two bob each, those who wanted to go. I was one of the party. On this particular Saturday we went down, it was raining like stink. There was no weather protection, no nothing. And we were conveyed down by the river by a tug from Risdon Beasley, pushing or pulling, I can't remember now which. As we approached Calshot, the weather and Calshot lived up to its reputation. The water was very turbulent, teeming in rain. If you wanted to obey the calls of nature, the only thing you could do was 1 foot on the side of the barge and the other on the tug. Somebody's all, with a whole host of people hanging on to you, because just as you started to get on board the tug, they parted, the waves were turbulent. It really was. And by now, the chairs were just sliding backwards and forwards with no rails at all to protect themselves. I do wonder how they got away with it even then.
That's what they call dropping the ocean.
Oh, but as we got near Calshot, when things were, the weather really was foul, the firm's speedboat, Schneider, came alongside with Mr. Westbrook on board, which was enough to put the fear of the Lord up you then, wasn't it? He was about, and with a loud hailer, he just announced that day the race had been cancelled because the weather conditions were too bad, and it would take place the next day. So we turned for home, and by now the majority of the people on board were sitting on the deck with the chairs over their head to try and protect from the rain. One man had bought a gramophone with him, a portable gramophone, but he only had one record. And all day long, the strains of "I'll be with you in apple blossom time" echoed down Southampton water. But the following day, the procedure was repeated, and of course, it was a glorious day. And if I remember rightly, it was Flight Lieutenant Stainforth.
Yeah, Stainforth.
And during the period, one flying officer Kinkead.
Killed.
That's right. And I had the pathetic box in my office of the various instruments and things that had been salvaged from her. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that
no,
just
I'm
brought a funny memory.
Period. You know, I'm trying to keep it chronological.
Yes.
He came straight up and so, and all of a sudden, he put, his nose went straight down,
straight
and he went straight in.
Straight underneath.
Straight in.
Was that in 31 or 29?
That would be
29.
Yes,
it just went straight in. There was one all nighty great splash and the aircraft disappeared. Yeah. Well, I would add that I was at Eastleigh on the day that the K-505 flew, first time. And I remember Matt Summers, who was quite a corpulent man, someone said to him, "Do you want a shoehorn to get him into the cockpit?" Because there wasn't a lot of room in that cockpit, you know. And we all...
If I could ask you now what memories you have of K-5054, the first prototype Spitfire, and its designer, R.J. Mitchell. Would you like to start with
I will, yeah. I remember R.J. Mitchell because I used to have to go to his house, which was in Portswood. I can't remember the name of the road. Apple.
Gordon Avenue.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And I remember him sitting in the garden in the chair, and he used to take the drawings off me, thank me very much. And Mrs. Mitchell used to give me sometimes a sweet and sometimes a cup of tea. And I used to go back on my bike to the works. Well, then, when K-5054, as I say, I was at Eastleigh under Len Levy. You remember, everybody remembers Len Levy. And I was doing a job on the wingtip of the K-5054 before it was taken over. And Mr. Levy kindly said to me, he said, "Well, son," he says, if you like to hang on, the airplane's going to fly today." And I remember the conversation that everybody was saying, "This is another one of Mitchell's cock-ups," because the original Spitfire, which was the one with the gold wing, was a bit of a failure, you see, and nobody thought this was going to be any good. But of course, when it did go, everybody, you know, Matt Summers come back down, I saw it fly, and Matt Summers come back down and said, "Don't touch it, it's perfect, leave it alone." And beside it was another little aircraft called the Vickers Vampire. But it was no match for the Spitfire. And it was the old Spitfire then was, it didn't look anything like it did when it was painted, because there was all odd shaped panels and all different colours on it, and it looked a bit of a wreck. But when it was flying, everybody realised what it was. And then some wig looked up and said, "It must be good because it looks good." And that was I remember of a Spitfire flying at Eastleigh. And I remember at the end of that day, I went back to Wollaston under the beady eyes of Weedy.
Did you have much contact with Mitchell apart from delivering drawings to his house?
He came down into the shop several times, because when we had queries, I suspect Vic remembers, we had a lot of queries on the leading edges, which were the root end of the leading edges. We had a lot of problems there. And he was a perfectionist, Mitchell was. And he'd come back and said that there's not the trouble with the design, it's not the trouble with the job, it's the trouble is with you people. And unfortunately, he was right. It was the way we were going about the job. And eventually, we mastered it, and the production went up and soared up. But of course, during the bombing, it was ripped to pieces. But
what was Mitchell like? Was he a fairly sharp-tongued man, or
no,
was he quiet?
No, he was. He was. You could say he was in between the two. He could be very sharp, but he could be very nice. He always spoke to you. Never passed by without speaking to you. If he'd had anything to do with you at all, and he'd just walk through the shop very brusquely and out he'd go, and then you'd see, but he was blowing old pipe stuck in his mouth, chewing away at his pipe, you know.
Yeah, us lads on the bench.
Dennis Mills, yeah.
Us lads on the bench there, he comes through the shop, and he's one of the few of the management that would stop and speak to you and say, "Any problems, son? How are you getting on? Are you enjoying it?" And basically, it was just a few words, but you really felt good because he spoke to you.
That's right.
You know, I say Westbrook and them and Elliot, they, so I should say Mr., they were Okay, they were management, but they were interested in talking to the general children, boys on the shop. So consequently, Mitchell had that respect from us.
Yes.
We always look forward to when he come up the shop, or when he talked to us, you know. And so he did.
Yes, I often had contacts with him, because by now, of course, excuse me, I had been transferred from Hythe to Woolston, still on embodiment loan section. But after a short period, the Spitfire project was now getting very active, and I was told, not requested, to take over the central telephone switchboard, because I had had, of course, experience at Hythe with the various RAF bases, and most of the work that I had was done in code. It came over from the RAF people in code. And I was experienced in this line, so I had to take over Woolston switchboard, which meant also I was often in contact with R.J. Mitchell, sometimes merely by telephone, but I shall remember him always as a fairly burly man, always, to my mind anyway, quiet and very pleasant. And whenever he wanted anything over telephone, he was so apologetic. Miss, would you mind getting me my house? Would you mind getting me Martlesham Heath, or wherever it was? And I was very fond of him. I can see him now, sometimes, walking through the sheds, and he would perhaps stop, as you've just said, squat his rear quarters down somewhere with his pipe in his mouth, and you could almost see the wheels ticking in his head. Remember, he was thinking and looking at the various craft, and obviously he'd walk away, and perhaps modifications would come as a result of that. But I remember one instance that impressed me, that has nothing to do really with the firm, but of R.J. Mitchell as a personality. It was the occasion of the firm's annual dance on the old Royal Pier ballroom. And where you gentlemen went there, but it was quite a nice affair, just before Christmas always. And there were lots of people there, obviously, the staff, employees, with their guests as well. And he came and found me and singled me out. And he said, Miss, my name then was Miss Mallion, M-A-L-Y-O-N. He said, you've spoken to my wife so many times on the telephone, which I had done to pass messages, I particularly want you to meet her. And the fact that he could, with such a crowd of people, be bothered to bring his wife over to meet me impressed me very much.
That was Mitchell.
Yes, he was a very nice man to my mind.
And of course, presumably you remember the sort of tragic months of his last illness as well.
Definitely, yes. I was quite friendly, of course, with his own secretary, Miss Vera Cross. And she came to me one morning, tapped on the switchboard room door, and she came in tears, and she said, have you heard? RJ's gone. And that particular day, I didn't really need her to tell me. I shall never know how the news broke. But throughout the rest of that day, the switchboard was literally jammed at times with condolence messages from various aircraft firms all over the world.
I'm very interested, you started talking about working on the wing of the Spitfire, because that to me is really the what made the Spitfire a successful aeroplane, bearing in mind its future development and performance, and where it even achieved a huge Mach number of about 9.2 when it was put through it. It strikes me that the wing, and of course the Schneider Trophy designs from which it developed, was the embodiment of the man himself. Yeah. I don't know if you'd like to sort of enlarge a bit on that, about what the wing was like to work on. Was it a complicated piece of metalwork?
Can you remember the system of cutting down excess threads?
Actually, I got paid for that. Yes.
You're the cause of that.
Actually, I got paid for it, yes.
I can blame you for all
we used to assemble the main spar, of course, there were hundreds of bolts went through, you see, both steel and high tensile and dural. And they used to crop them off with bolt cutters and then file them flat. Well, at that time we were on bonus, and everybody was thinking, you know, if we agree on a time, then anything we bring out to our advantage is our own business. And I thought of I'd once seen a cutter which this chap was using to cut down on a face, that cut the face clean, you see. So I got a box banner, and I cut a hole in the side of the box banner and ground a drill
which was had a blade on one side and a clearance on the other side. And we used to put this box spanner on top of the bolt, put the drill in, and take it off just like that. Of course, we all made quite a bit of money on the spars,
yeah,
didn't we?
Yeah, a few burns as well.
And I put the idea forward, and after a lot of arguing, I got £5, which was a lot of money.
Yeah, that box spanner, eventually we put a little piece of bar on it.
That's right.
Well, it was,
so you could hold it and not hurt your finger. Otherwise, the box spanner used to get hot. In fact, I still got some in my original toolbox at home now. Yeah. And I got paid for that.
They always said it took a lot more man-hours to assemble a Spitfire wing compared to a Hurricane wing, which was much...
Yes, because it was very much sturdier, very much stronger. You had the Reynolds drawn tube spars, you see, and they used to drill those in a great long jig, which was a turnover jig, drilled those. Then the components were taken out and they were laid on the bench and they were all assembled. And they used to have a big drawing in front of them with, and eventually ended up, when the women were doing it, with coloured bolts so that they could tell the difference between the dural and the tensile steel bolts. Mm. It was quite a complicated job, but very easy to assemble. Very easy. The leading edge was very easy to do indeed. A bit problematic when you come to skinning it, but even that was got over in time. And the wing, it was a very easy job. It was quite easy.
Putting the plating on, we used to have the main spar and the leading edge and the jig.
That's right.
And then the other sheets were always cut to size and rolled. So we fastened them at the bottom on the main spar with bolts, drew a few holes. And then the top part, we had about 3 or 4 holes along the plate, which is about 3 to 4 foot long in width. And then the turnbuckles from there onto the jig, and then tension those up so the whole sheet was tight against the ribs. And then from the bottom you used to drill up the ribs and fasten as you went up. So you worked from the spar right up to the rear spar, and you got the whole sheet. And then once you got all fastened, the rivets would come along and rivet it up in position. Because it was a simple way of doing it. Stressing the sheet to the actual shape.
Because it had to be simple enough for hastily trained wartime production workers.
That's right. Well, this is it. It was
on
the
lines,
the speed.
You know, with no engineering skills from day one.
You're talking about me again now.
Think, can you tell us a bit about on this subject? On 5054, you were involved.
No,
in that,
I wasn't actually.
You weren't.
Because these two gentlemen are a great deal older than me. They started before me.
Did you see the first flight?
No, I didn't.
No.
There was a point there that before the aircraft was completed, it was rather amusing that the Germans, they had the Bremen and the Europa, and the gentlemen remember it, they used to have a red seaplane. Used to come up.
The Tornado and the...
Used to come up and moor off the jetty there in the river. They used to come ashore with a mail, the Germans used to come ashore with a mail, come through the factory, and on the way through they'd pass a piece of tarpaulin, and the 504 was being built behind that tarpaulin.
Yeah, that tarpaulin.
And they knew that aircraft was going to defeat them.
They were actually let into the woods.
They knew exactly where to go.
That's not all. They took all these precautions to camouflage the Spitfire as it was. But over in the far side of the shop, nearby where he worked, was a party of German engineers erecting a steam hammer.
That's right, yeah.
A drop hammer. And they wandered around the works at free will.
They made the machinery that helped to build the Spitfire, which helped to destroy them.
They did.
But I mean, the Messerschmitt 108 had a resemblance to the Spitfire. Was that the reason or not? Or what did it precede the Spitfire?
Well, no, it had a resemblance to the Spitfire.
Well, the wings didn't they?
Because the dihedral, the wing was very much different. Now, when the first Messerschmitt that was captured was taken to Eastleigh, in the main hangar. Now, I bet you all remember. You might remember this. And it was set up on trestle in flying position, you see, for it to be inspected by the RAF. Well, the RAF came down to have a look at it, and one senior gentleman got in the cockpit you see, and he pressed the button, and there was one almighty bloody bang, and a hole appeared in the wall. There was a cannon shot, the spake which no one thought, you see, which went through the propeller boss at that time, and that hole remained there until De Savry knocked it down last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fact. And then the Messerschmitt was a very different aircraft from the Spitfire, very different. It was not quite so robust, but it was a very good aircraft. And of course they went up in stages as the Messerschmitts came out, the Gustav and the Freddy, so the Spitfire was advanced to catch up with it. And of course it was eventually overtaken by the Focke Wulf 190, which was a better aircraft than the Spitfire.
Talking about the robustness of the Spitfire, we used to get photographs of some of the conditions they used to come back in.
That's right.
The tree trunks through the wings.
Remember
and everything
the
else.
Polish pilot that came back with 2/3 of a telegraph pole in his
That's
wing?
That's right. Remember the photograph.
And I remember standing up underneath the wing. I could stand up and I was standing up and waving to the lads, and I was actually through the wing. Where there was a hole, a direct hit had knocked a hole through the wing. It was a very, very robust aircraft, very robust. But it was entirely different to the Messerschmitt.
Well, I was working on a wing up at an aircraft up at Easton, and they put a service aircraft in alongside. And instead of working to the manual for repair schemes, there was old pieces of metal put on the Schubert rivets, and I counted on one wing 87 patches.
Yeah,
on one wing of this aircraft.
Well, after the bombing, we did repair jobs at Winchester Road.
Oh, yeah.
On shrapnel damage to cowling panels, wings, and everything else.
Yeah. Well, then it itching when after the bombing, it was just like a load of leaves falling all over the place.
We used to call it a penny patch squad, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The penny patch squad.
See?
And we used to do the bullet holes. Because your bullet went through and it'd leave a clean hole on the outside but a burr like a thing inside, you see. And what they used to do is just knock it flat and then cut it out the size of the whatever the hole would take, you see. And then put a round liner in the back with a peat and bosphin on it, which just fitted flush to the skin, rivet it round, rub it off it went. And they were manufactured these, what we used to call penny patches. And they'd fly off with 50, 60 of these damn things in there. And I mean, I've seen it well, I'll tell you what happened to me. I was at Yeovilton once, and a sea fire came in at Yeovilton. And the far side of the aerodrome was a hut. And this sea fire overran itself, and it went straight through this blessed hut, bang. And the only damage to the Spitfire was the prop was bent. Yet it knocked the hut to absolutely pieces.
Could we tell you about the procedures for using the toilet?
Yes. By all means.
Well, I had to report to the chappie in the little cubicle. He would then put down the time. He would give us a little round
brass tape.
Yeah, that's right. Brass tape.
And you would proceed to the toilet, and then you would report back out. Give your tally in, and he would record the time that you took.
5 minutes.
Seven minutes.
Seven minutes, and that was all. Over that, you got 4 hours deducted.
But you're only allowed to go once a day. If you went twice a day,
time and moment.
Then you had it. You had a medical report to say you were qualified to go twice a day. I unfortunately went once in the morning. Nothing to talk about normally, but I went once in the morning, and then in the afternoon I had to go again. I put my name down, never said anything, but when I got back into the workshop, the charger said, "Oh, Mr. Cam wants to see you." I went in the office. He said, "I understand you've been to the toilet twice today. Can you have any medical reasons?" And I had to make an excuse that it was quite unexpected how to go, but you're more or less a third degree.
Yeah.
Because you went to the toilet twice in one day. Or if you're over the 7 minutes, then again you would be reported.
This applied also to the staff, the ladies' staff. If you remember, the old firm, the main erecting machine shop and erecting shop, was situated virtually in the middle of the firm, Woolston I'm talking about. Yeah. And on the farther side was the garage and Harry Gingell, the garage man. And the offices were completely the other side. We were allowed half time through the morning to make a dash to the ladies' toilet. But it meant leaving the offices and running like mad through the erecting shop to right through to get to the toilet spot the other side, with every man by his machine roaring his head off with laughter. And when we got in the ladies' toilet, it was a big room with lots of cubicles all round. Cubicles were all numbered, and right in the middle of the floor was a little glass cubicle where the old lady in charge of the toilet sat, a Mrs. Hooper. And she would time you as you came down. Again, you had a little tally, and if you were behind you, she knew which cubicle door you'd gone in. And you'd hardly been in there, and she'd come out of her office and hammer on the door. Come on in there, you've been in there long enough, your time's up. Now, it sounds...
Right.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. Oh, yes.
They reckon she saved enough time to justify her own wages.
Yeah. Yes. And this is a very personal thing, too. Yeah. But for the same thing, as regards to the economy, there was nothing, no toilet tissues or anything ever left in the cubicles. No. You had to rush out and ask the old lady in the office. Yes. Because they said the toilet rolls were being pinched.
A big hole cut in the door. Yeah. So that you could get. It was incredible. Yeah. I would never consider working under those conditions again. Never.
No.
You made one mistake and you were out.
Yes.
Never had two. One mistake.
Even though you're a skilled man.
Don't matter what it is, you made one mistake. You put a 3/16 hole where it should be an 8 and you were out.
Oh yes. And even from the office staff to the ladies there, it was a well-known fact right throughout Southampton. If you could hold a job at Supermarine, yeah, as in any office scale, you could get a job anywhere.
Yeah.
And yet the wages were so low.
We were told that if we were apprentices.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you could go anywhere in the world.
I was given the sack once, but reinstated by Jim Wiggins.
Yes.
We were in the habit of going onto the roof and sunbathing in the summer. Was that a roof?
Roof.
And this mate of mine wasn't an apprentice. I wasn't. And we both came down the ladder at the sound of the restart bell, and Jim Weedy was waiting for us at the bottom. We must have been a few seconds after the bell. So he told us to get our papers, money and cards. And I suppose later on he eventually found out that my mate was an apprentice, and you couldn't sack him for that. And you reinstated him and had to reinstate me as well.
That's right. He was a terror. There was no other word for it. He was a terror to work for. You were straight out the gate if you made one mistake.
Got the work done, didn't you?
Oh, we got the work done. Yes. But you could, right opposite the main gate, enter the main.